The Miracle of the Great Saint Nicholas 1920. Chapter 1. Nicholas, a scion of an illustrious family of Vervignol, showed marks of sanctity from his earliest childhood, and at the age of 14 vowed to consecrate himself to the Lord. Having embraced the ecclesiastical profession, he was raised, while still young, by popular acclamation and the wish of the chapter, to the see of St. Cromadaire, the apostle of Vervignol, and first bishop of Trinquebal. He exercised his pastoral ministry with piety, governed his clergy with wisdom, taught the people, and feared not to remind the great of justice and moderation. He was liberal, profuse in almsgiving, and set aside for the poor the greater part of his wealth. His castle proudly lifted its crenellated walls and pepper-pot roofs from the summit of a hill overlooking the town. He made of it a refuge where all who were pursued by the secular arm might find a place of refuge. In the lower hall, the largest to be seen in all Vervignol, the table laid for meals was so long that those who sat at one end saw it lose itself in the distance in an indistinct point, and when the torches upon it were lighted it recalled the tale of the comet which appeared in Vervignol to announce the death of King Comus. The holy Saint Nicholas sat at the upper end. There he entertained the principal folk of the town and of the kingdom, and a multitude of clergy and laymen. But on his right there was always reserved a seat for the poor man who might come begging for his bread at the door. Children, particularly, aroused the solicitude of the good St. Nicholas. He delighted in their innocence, and he felt for them with the heart of a father and the bowels of a mother. He had the virtues and the morals of an apostle. Yearly, in the dress of a simple monk, with a white staff in his hand, he would visit his flock, desirous of seeing everything with his own eyes, and in order that no adversity or disorder should escape his notice he would traverse, accompanied by a single priest, the wildest parts of his diocese, crossing, in winter, the flooded rivers, climbing mountains, and plunging into the thick forests. One day, having ridden since dawn upon his mule, in company with the deacon Modernus, thorny thickets through which his mount with difficulty forced a winding path. The deacon Modernus followed him with much difficulty on his mule, which carried the baggage. Overcome with hunger and fatigue, the man of God said to Modernus, "Let us halt here, my son, and if you still have a little bread and wine we will sup here, for I feel that I hardly have the strength to proceed further, and you, although the younger, must be nearly as tired as I." "Monseigneur," answered Modernus, "there remains neither a drop of wine nor a crumb of bread, for, by your orders, I gave all to some people on the road, who had less need of it than ourselves." "Without a doubt," replied the bishop, "had there been a few scraps left in your wallet we should have eaten them with pleasure, for it is fitting that those who govern the church should be nourished on the leavings of the poor. But since you have nothing left it is because God has desired it so, and he has surely desired it for our good and profit. It is possible that he will forever hide from us the reason of this favor, perhaps, on the other hand, he will quickly make it manifest. Meanwhile, I think the only thing left for us is to push on until we find some arbutus berries and blackberries for our own nourishment, and some grass for our mules, and, being thus refreshed, to lie down upon a bed of leaves."
"As you please, Monseigneur," answered Modernus, pricking his mount. They traveled all night, and a part of the following morning, then, having climbed a fairly steep ascent, they suddenly found themselves at the border of the wood, and beheld at their feet a plain covered by a yellowish sky, and crossed by four white roads, which lost themselves in the mist. They took that to the left, an old Roman road, formerly frequented by merchants and pilgrims, but deserted since the war had laid waste this part of Vervignol. Dense clouds were gathering in the sky, across which birds were flying, a stifling atmosphere weighed down upon the dumb, livid earth. Lightning flashed on the horizon. They urged on their wearied mules. Suddenly a mighty wind bent the tops of the trees, making the boughs crack and the battered foliage moan. The thunder muttered, and heavy drops of rain began to fall. As they made their way through the storm, the lightning flashing about them, along a road which had become a torrent, they perceived, by the light of a flash, a house outside which there hung a branch of holly, the sign of hospitality. The inn appeared deserted, nevertheless, the host advanced towards them, a man fierce yet humble, with a great knife at his belt, and asked what they wished for. "A lodging, and a scrap of bread, with a drop of wine," answered the bishop, "for we are weary and benumbed with cold." While the host was fetching wine from the cellar, and Modernus was taking the mules to the stable, St. Nicholas, sitting at the hearth beside a dying fire, cast a glance round the smoky room. Dust and dirt covered the benches and casks, spiders spun their webs between the worm-eaten joists, whence hung scanty bunches of onions. In a dark corner the salting tub displayed its iron-hooped belly. In those days the demons used to take a hand in domestic life in a far more intimate fashion than they do today. They haunted houses, concealed in the salt box, the butter tub, or some other hiding place. They spied upon the people of the house, and watched for the opportunity to tempt them and lead them into evil. Then, too, the angels made more frequent appearances among Christian folk. Now a devil, as big as a hazelnut, who was hidden among the burning logs, spoke up and said to the holy bishop, "Look at that salting tub, Father, it is well worth a look. It is the best salting tub in the whole of Vervignol. It is, indeed, the model and paragon of salting tubs. When the master here, Seigneur Garam, received it from the hands of a skillful cooper, he perfumed it with juniper, thyme, and rosemary. Seigneur Garam has not his equal in bleeding the meat, boning it, and cutting it up, carefully, thoughtfully, and lovingly, and steeping it in salted liquors by which it is preserved and embalmed. He is without a rival for seasoning, concentrating, boiling down, skimming, straining, and decanting the pickle. Taste his mild cured pork, Father, and you will lick your fingers. Taste his mild cured pork, Nicholas, and you will have something to say about it." But in these words, and above all in the voice that uttered them, it grated like a saw. The holy bishop recognized an evil spirit. He made the sign of the cross, whereupon the little devil exploded with a horrible noise and a very bad smell, just like a chestnut thrown into the fire without having had its skin split. And an angel from heaven appeared, resplendent in light, and said to Nicholas, "Nicholas, beloved of the Lord, you must know that three little children have been in that salting tub for 7 years. Garam, the innkeeper, cut up these tender infants, and put them in salt and pickle. Arise, Nicholas, and pray that they may come to life again. For, if you intercede for them, O Pontiff, the Lord, who loves you, will restore them to life." During this speech Modernus entered the room, but he did not see the angel, nor did he hear him, for he was not sufficiently holy to be able to communicate with the heavenly spirits. The angel further said, "Nicholas, son of God, lay your hands on the salting tub, and the three children will be resuscitated." The blessed Nicholas, filled with horror, pity, zeal, and hope, gave thanks to God, and when the innkeeper reappeared with a jug in either hand, the saint said to him in a terrible voice, "Garam, open the salting tub."